You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than
hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. My studio guest today is Benjamin Johncock. He's author of The Last Pilot, his debut novel. We'll also be hearing from Siobhan Costello, who teaches entrepreneurs how to write business books, and local author Daryl Oliver on her debut novel, Steel Wool. But hello, Ben.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. Self-help books, business books, have you got much experience of self-help books?
Not really. The thing about self-help books is I think they published sold 40 million copies last year or something, which is, I find curious, because I wonder if they really worked. Why do they keep need to publishing more of them?
That is a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. So my self-help book would be the Bible, I suppose. I'm a Christian, so yeah.
Do you refer to that a lot? Is that sort of by your side?
Yeah, before I write, actually, every day I read a little scripture, and it just provides me with like a real rock solid grounding, like a real wholesome truth that sets me up for the day.
New Testament or Old Testament?
I prefer the New, to be honest with you.
Wow, I never thought of the Bible as a self-help book, but now you put it like that, I guess it is, really.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but let's start with your first piece of music now that you've chosen. This is short and sweet. This is Justin Timberlake and Oscar Isaac. Please, Mr. Kennedy, why this one?
I was sent this by my editor just after she bought The Last Pilot, and she'd been listening to this clip. It's from a film called I think it's called Inside Llewyn Davis, and it's a little ditty, very appropriate for the time period, and it talks about this guy who's very reluctant to be an astronaut and go into space. And so I was singing this song for weeks and weeks and weeks, and when the book was sold, in this level of kind of high excitement, and just really enjoying a really, really fun tune.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1
second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Please don't shoot me in the outer space.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
That's Justin Timberlake and Please Mr. Kennedy, the first choice of music today on Bookmark from our studio guest, Benjamin Johncock. Benjamin is a former winner of Comma Press's National Short Story Day Award. Earlier this year, his debut novel, The Last Pilot, won the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, and the reviews have been glittering. Ian Rankin said it was a hugely impressive piece of work. The Daily Mail described it as riveting and beautifully written, and Joanne Harris said it was by far the best debut novel she'd read in years. I have to say, I concur with all those reviews. It's a quite remarkable piece of work. How did it feel to get those reviews?
It was all, you never know how these things are going to be received, and you spend ages, you know, 7 years in this case, sitting by yourself writing it, and you know, you don't know if anyone's even going to read it. So when they started to come in, it was sort of mind-blowing, I think.
7 years?
Yeah.
Why so long?
It takes a long time. Part of it was because I was, when I started out, I had a full-time job, and then I had a baby, and that was also very time-consuming. And I promised my wife that after her 10 months maternity leave was up, I would have finished the book. But sort of 3 years later, I still hadn't quite got it finished. The way I work, it takes a long time. I tend to write by hand. So I wrote The Last Pilot in pencil and paper, and I would do this thing where I would write a line or a paragraph, you know, sometimes a page, and then set it aside and then copy it out. And literally copy it out word for word. And in doing that, I would edit in the space between the two. So what I found was a process of distillation, a process of sort of omission would take place in that gap. And then I would do that again, and I'd do it again, and I'd do it again. And, you know, there were some chapters that went through, you know, 25, 30 drafts like that. So I've got like huge stacks of paper at home. And then I type it up eventually, which would be a sort of a draft in itself. And then you do the usual thing where you kind of print and scribble and print and scribble and stuff. So that's partly why it took so long. I remember there were lines in the book that I perhaps would spend a morning working on. And I'd kind of go home and my wife would be like, oh, you know, what'd you get today? You know, word count wise. I'd be like, got a line.
12 wonderful words.
But the thing is, I'm more proud of the stuff that I didn't write. So I could have written 500 words, 1,000 words. And I'm more proud of the fact that I didn't write those because they wouldn't have been good enough. You know, I'm more proud of what I left out in some respects than what I put in.
That does seem a very elaborate process to get the thoughts from your head onto the page. How did you come about? How did you discover that process? And why did you?
Oh, that's an excellent.
If it works for you, fine. But why not just write it straight on a PC?
Yeah, no, that's such an excellent question. And I kind of learned how to do this by I'd written sort of 3 novels before that were progressively, hopefully, less crap. And when I got to this one, I find myself starting to kind of hit my stride a little bit, working out how on earth to do this thing. And so I decided to just start writing in pencil because I was doing I did a short story sort of halfway through writing this book because I wanted to see if I could write a short fiction, which I'd never done before. And I started to do that for some reason with pencil and a pad, and found that actually that process of then just being not satisfied with something and then ripping out and setting it aside, and it was actually really helpful. It really worked for me. Like, I think that different writers write in different ways. And but this seemed to do something for me and for my prose. And so once I'd finished doing this short story, I took that back to the novel and started applying it to that. And just found that the process of using a pencil to be such an organic process, you're so much closer to the words. You know, you could smell the lead, and you know that your pencil, your tool, gets smaller the more you write, which is, you know, quite a lovely thing that you don't get so much these days. And I find that if you're writing directly on a word processor, it's very final. People kind of can edit, in inverted commas, on a screen. And I don't want to sound obnoxious about it, but I just think that, you know, moving paragraphs around or deleting sentences or chopping it, that to me isn't like a deep edit. I think, you know, if you've got a problem with something, and you know, when you're writing you have lots of problems, you actually have to deconstruct something and then put it back together again. You know, I think if you've got a problem with your car, you know, you don't just sort of, you know, tighten the bolts on the doors, you take the engine apart and you put it back together again. So it was this constant process of disassembly and then reassembly, and then leaving as many parts as I could, you know, behind.
Well, let's talk about the parts that got to the page then. For anybody who hasn't read The Last Pilot, can you give a brief resume?
Sure. When people ask me what it's about, the obvious thing to say is, oh, well, it's about the space race in America. Actually, it's not. It's about a marriage in crisis. And that marriage in crisis between this young couple takes place with the space race as a backdrop. Our main character, Jim Harrison, is a test pilot in the US Air Force. And these are the guys that were testing supersonic airplanes in the Mojave Desert in the late 40s. And early 50s, and it was these people that the government looked to become the first astronauts when Project Mercury started up. And what I found really interesting, actually, on that side of things, was that the really, really the best pilots had no interest at all in being astronauts because they weren't in control of the thing they were supposed to be flying. So the best pilots actually, just wanted nothing to do with it. It was only a bit later on when they could see that those early astronauts managed to wrestle back some control in the design of the things, that they became interested and saw it as the new flying frontier. So it's about a marriage in crisis. It's about a couple who undergo quite a sad thing, quite a tragic thing. I don't want to give too much away. And it's about how they as a couple and how Jim as a man deals with that kind of loss.
And why did you set it in the context of the space race? Because if it's a marriage in crisis, it could be set anywhere. Was it a period of time and a subject that particularly interested you?
It was, and has been for a long time. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, my dad would read to me from a book called Moonflight Atlas, which was written by Patrick Moore. Not traditional children's bedtime story, but it told the story of Apollo 13, which was obviously the, you know, disastrous, near-fatal aborted mission to the moon. And what fascinated me back then, it wasn't the rockets and the spaceships, like, you know, boys and girls are interested in when they're young. It was the men And it was these men who were able to stay so calm and so focused and so cool under such extreme pressure and in such peril that really captivated me. You know, I was an anxious child, and I think I saw something in them that I kind of really aspired to. And then, you know, later in life, I kind of, it kind of stayed with me, you know, and I met a few moonwalkers kind of growing up, which was cool. But it wasn't until sort of my early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, and I developed an anxiety disorder. And I found myself after a couple of years of just, you know, hellish time, when I started to write again, coming back to those childhood heroes of mine, you know, these guys who could stay so cool under pressure and just found myself writing about them because it was the complete opposite, do you know what I mean, of me.
And what is interesting about it, from my point of view in the book, is it questions what scale is, really, doesn't it? Because, as you say, there is this tragedy that affects the couple that is enormous. And yet he is flying these jets and these planes that could go into space. What is important in that context?
Yeah, I found it interesting that, you know, these guys would take up their, you know, if you're testing a car, you know, what's the worst that can happen? That, you know, maybe you would roll it and maybe a tire would fall off. But if you're testing a new aircraft that no one really has put through its paces before, and you're at 70,000 feet and the red light on the panel, you know, goes up, and you've got 3 seconds to decide, you know, whether to do A, B or C. A and B will almost certainly result in your death, and C is the thing that gets you home. And, you know, they do this 2 or 3 times a day. That was an interesting tension I found to a marriage anyway. But these guys were so emotionally closed, they had to be, because you couldn't allow fear or panic in the cockpit during these moments. And I wondered about how someone like that would deal with, you know, a domestic situation, their marriage, and also, you know, a tragic loss in their personal life. And a lot of that was based on an experience that actually was from Neil Armstrong in his younger days. And I found it very interesting that when he died in 2012, none of the obituaries, and bear in mind, I'm sort of halfway writing the book at this point, none of the obituaries mentioned this thing that happened to him in his early life, which spoke so much to what a closed guy he was, that even some of his closest colleagues at the time, you know, didn't realize that this thing happened. So I drew a lot of inspiration from that, from his experience.
And how much is it truth and fiction? Because there are real people.
Oh yeah, there are lots of real people. What I wanted to do was write a story where I had the history. And it is as almost pinpointed exact to what happened. I've barely changed anything. And I had my fictional story. And my idea was to dovetail them both together so that the reader wouldn't be able to see the join. And I also wanted to, if you took them apart, that they would both work as independent stories. So you have sort of the history of the space race and all the stuff that happened and all the characters that involved. And you had my fictional characters, and they kind of just slotted together. So that's what I was.
That does work. I mean, it is.
That's why it took 7 years.
That's why, yeah. Another reason, not just the pencil. But I mean, it's well-worn territory, isn't it? You've got Tom Wolfe, Raymond Carver. Mm-hmm. Lots of writers have covered that period. So when you go into that, you must be confident that you can bring something different to it.
I don't think any writer goes into anything with confidence. And I think if they do, it's probably a mistake, and they'll probably end up writing not particularly good prose. I think you've got to go into it worried. I think you've got to go into it fearful and terrified if you can pull it off or bring anything new, you know. And I think that's the best attitude to be, you know, at any stage of a writer's career. And, you know, now sort of writing my second novel, I wanted to make sure I got back into that place of terror.
Yes, because I suppose it's the adrenaline. It's like an actor needs adrenaline almost.
Yeah, and it makes you push harder. It makes you kick harder. It makes you edit sharper. It makes you just be so aware and sensitive and respectful. And I just think if a writer thinks themselves as amazing, they will produce rubbish prose. But if a writer thinks that, oh my goodness, I'm terrified of being rubbish, then they will hopefully then go on to produce something worth reading.
You must have been pleased with the review from Metro. The last pilot may be Benjamin Johncock's first book, but it reads like he's a seasoned pro. That's nice, isn't it? Because sometimes debut novelists can sort of feel hesitant tentativeness, but somebody obviously felt you were very comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, and the reviews from the States in particular, because it's a very American story, and I'm a Brit writing an American story. I mean, those were amazing. I mean, you know, to be compared to Hemingway, that was
supercharged Hemingway. Yeah,
yeah. I never even dreamed of. Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. So yeah, they were amazing. But I mean, I think it's important to go, well, that's very nice. Thank you very much. I'm gonna pop that in the desk drawer, and then I'm gonna go back to work. Because if you let that kind of stuff, you know, swell your ego, you just go to the page and you just kind of, you know, you think you're the best thing since sliced bread and you're just going to produce rubbish.
Well, we will come back to that Hemingway comparison, because I want to ask you about the dialogue and the description. It's a very spare style of writing, isn't it? But we'll hear now from another debut novelist. Daryl Oliver worked as a nurse and is currently studying for a master's degree in healthcare. I started when I met Daryl by asking her to tell me about her debut novel, Steel Wool.
It's about a chap who develops Alzheimer's disease. He's a very intelligent person. He's a Cambridge graduate, and his wife has to care for him, and the book is about her feelings, her emotions, and how she tries to overcome them and the dilemmas she faces.
And this is a very real subject for many people,
isn't it? Absolutely, yes. It's quite frightening and bewildering, because most people haven't encountered it before, and when they come across it, they sort of don't know what to do. They're totally bewildered, and the loss of that person they knew is fading away in front of their eyes, more or less, and it's frightening.
And I think it's a subject a lot of people are fearful about, not just because it affects their loved ones, but fearful of it affecting themselves.
Absolutely, yes. And the other thing I found when I was working with dementia patients, so many families didn't know what to expect. They had no idea of the progression of the disease, what sort of things they might encounter. And so I wanted to write the book as a sort of a reassurance, in a way, that the feelings they were going through were perfectly normal and they could relate to other people suffering in the same way.
So at what point, you have a background in nursing, what point in your professional life did you think, I want to write something about this?
Because I think it's the most heart-wrenching, devastating illness out there. There's lots of terrible illnesses out there, to be sure, but Alzheimer's is one of the worst.
And as a nurse, you've probably seen it affect very young people as well as
Absolutely.
The elderly.
Yes, it's not just for the elderly. In the book, the chap involved, Arthur Pavin, he is only in his 60s. Okay, it's not young, but it's not old. And I've seen people in their 30s and 40s have Alzheimer's, so it can affect anybody.
Was there a particular case that struck you that made you think, you know, I've got to put this down?
Not really. What confounded me, rather, was the fact that it can affect intelligent people, people with the lower than average intelligence, people, professional people. It's indiscriminate. It doesn't, you know, it just attacks anybody. And whilst the Alzheimer's Research Association are doing their level best to find a cure, in the meanwhile, I felt it was necessary for people to be aware of what sort of experiences they might encounter and to not be frightened of it, because it is a dreadful illness. It's a terminal illness, but it's like any other terminal illness, and they've got to know the stages that the person will go through, including violence, loss of hygiene, when people don't recognise their loved ones. That's quite frightening. All these things are in the book, and how Grace deals with her husband. Grace is the wife carer. How she deals with her husband, she goes through so many different emotions and stresses, and at the end of it, she reaches a resolution, but it's so, so difficult to reach that resolution.
How much of what you saw professionally did you push in the book?
Quite a bit. All the experiences I've had nursing people with dementia. So many times people with dementia are not aware of it usually. I think I mention in the book something about the doctor coming in to see Arthur when he's had a fall, and he's quite adamant that he doesn't want to see the doctor. There's nothing wrong with him. And the doctor asks him to breathe out, and he breathes out. So he's really not aware of what's going on. He's certainly not aware of his wife and her feelings, and he's not aware that he's causing this awful grief, and eventually he starts to attack her. She can't deal with it. But at the same time, she feels terribly guilty that she can't deal with it, because she loves him. It's her husband and she wants to care for him. But the confusion that she feels is, should I relinquish that care to somebody else to look after him, or should I try and stay loyal to him?
So these characters, Arthur and Grace, where did they come from?
That's totally fictional, but based on truth, on the experiences I've had. looking after people.
And when you sat down to write the novel, did you plot it out?
Yeah, I mean, it was just sort of various thoughts and ideas went through my head, and I thought, I really must put this down. It was kind of cathartic for me, because I found looking after dementia patients, even though I'm a nurse, was quite traumatic and very stressful. And I wanted to write about it and put it down so that it would be out there somewhere, but I didn't ever think that it would turn into a book.
And how does it feel now that it is a book?
That's wonderful. I hope people can read it and relate to it if they need to. I mean, that was the whole idea of it, really. We all need to relate to things, and when strange things happen and frightening things happen, we need to be able to say, well, yes, actually, that's how it is. But if you've not experienced it before, then you're totally confused by it.
And this is your first novel.
It is.
Yes. What did you learn about writing by writing your first novel?
I very much enjoyed it. I'm not a good fiction writer. I tend to write about factual things. So it's a combination of the two things, really. Writing about what really happened, but putting it into a story. I enjoyed that part.
And any future novels planned?
Yes, yes, I have another novel half written at the moment. And that one's going to be about cerebral palsy. But that's a totally different thing, as you realise. And again, it's about people suffering and how to overcome them.
You're not scared of taking on these difficult subjects?
No, not really, because I've had a vast experience in my life of so many difficulties, both professionally and personally. So it's all in there somewhere.
And I guess the nursing background means that you've seen individual stories, actually. You know, you've seen things that you can put into the book.
Well, it does. And I mean, as I said, so many families I spoke to, they're just terrified by it, and they didn't understand what was happening to their loved ones and didn't know what to expect. Nobody had explained to them. And because dementia is so varying in its progression, people have to be aware of the various stages that person might go through.
That was Daryl Oliver there talking about her debut novel, Steel Wool, which is published by Austin Macaulay Publishers. Talking about characters there, and Daryl was talking about the central characters in her novel. The central characters in your novel are Jim and Grace Harrison.
Yeah.
Where did they come from?
Jim really was a slight amalgamation of, you know, sort of several. He's a little part Chuck Yeager. He's a little part Jim Lovell. He's a little part me. He's a little part Han Solo. So it's kind of
Han Solo.
Yeah. So he's kind of So I'm just, you know, just creating that character and touching on those things. Grace, I don't know. I think Grace is probably my favourite character in the book. Because I wanted to. This was a very male dominated profession, and this was a very male dominated world, but I did not want to write a woman who was just there in the background as, you know, the wife, you know, as it was really important to me that she was as, you know, as strong and as brilliant and as resourceful and resilient, and that she would be in real life, and, you know, which she really had to be, living out in the Mojave, such a lonely place to live, and then moving to Houston when Jim, you know, does go on to start his astronaut training and experiencing a similar loneliness, but in a very different, in a very different situation. So that was very important to me.
Let's talk about dialogue, because I wanted to come back to that point about Hemingway. There's a lot of dialogue in the book. In fact, it's very naturalistic dialogue, and you're often content to let dialogue run the scene, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that comes from a couple of things. One is that I don't feel like I'm very good at, like, describing stuff. And I get so bored. A character kind of goes into a room, and I'm just like, right, you know, what does this room look like? I can't do it. I just find it deeply tedious. And also, I think a lot of it is completely unnecessary. I think, you know, sometimes you get books, and, you know, there are books that are very good with beautiful, rich descriptions and stuff. That's great, but that's kind of not what I do. A lot of the times, though, when people are describing, you know, the minutiae of, like, you know, someone having a cup of tea and, you know, putting it down and moving across the room, I'm just like, you know, this is so unnecessary. And a lot of what I want to do is get the reader to input as much as they can into the story as me. So the idea is that by leaving stuff out as much as I can, the reader fills in those gaps with their own experiences, their own thoughts. You know, if I get too specific, then I'm kind of not letting the reader provide that information. You know, if I'm describing a couch, then it's not leaving the reader any in of their own. Whereas if I just mention it, then the reader, you know, what do they picture? Maybe they picture the couch that they, you know, I don't know, that have at home, or that they, you know, lost their virginity on, or they held their firstborn on, or something like that. They're adding something themselves to the story. So you have a process where the reader leans in a little bit more. And the idea is that if you have the reader and the writer coming together in a much more intimate way, your emotional resonance at the end of the book, which is kind of what it's all about, should be that much more powerful, should be that much greater.
Well, that is true with the dialogue as well, isn't it? Because it's the things that often aren't said.
Yeah,
because
that's
we're privy to the thought processes.
Yeah.
And I'm interested how you put it on the page. It's quite a technical question, this, but it was a decision you obviously made at some point to not put quotation marks in.
Oh, the quotation mark things. Yeah, if I'd known how many people were going to ask me about the quotation mark things, I would have put them in. So I wanted to do some things with the prose that were subtle, and I felt like using quotation marks in those circumstances just drew too much attention to the dialogue, and we're just sort of like, here is some dialogue, you know. But I wanted I wanted dialogue to kind of flow into the rest of the conversation without it being too jarring. I think I found that the quotation marks separated things out too much, and I found it jarring.
Well, it does work. It feels like it's organic with the rest of the writing, which is presumably
there's one scene with Jim and Pancho where there isn't actually anything but dialogue in that whole scene. And when I started doing that, I was about halfway through and I realised what I was doing, and I thought, okay, this is interesting. Can I do this whole scene without any description at all, you know, without any, you know, attributions? So that was a fun thing to do.
It begs the question about screenplays, doesn't it? Have you thought about writing it as a screenplay?
Yeah, I have started the screenplay, actually. Yeah, so that's in progress because the book is, they say, you know, out in Hollywood. So film studios are reading it, and we're getting some, you know, very positive responses, but a few close calls, but nothing yet. You know, so please, Mr. Hanks, you know, if you're listening.
Oh, how exciting. Well, we're going to listen to your second choice of music now. This is a great track. I hadn't heard this before. Grant Nicholas, Time Stood Still. Why this one?
I used to work for a band. I used to do a bit of work for a band called Feeder, which Grant was the lead singer of, and you know, the main guy behind. So I kind of worked with them for a while. As I moved away from sort of doing music industry stuff into writing, you know, Feeder's music obviously stayed with me a lot. And then Grant produced a solo album, which came out at the summer when I was doing the bulk of the editing. And so I would listen to this tune and a couple of other ones of his walking into work. I live in Norwich, and I'd kind of walk in, listen to this. And this is very reminiscent of that time when I was having to pull, because I was on quite tight deadlines in terms of getting the edits turned around. I was sort of pulling sort of 14, 15, 16 hour days. And the only way that I could do that was to, you know, go in to work with a really positive attitude, drink a lot of coffee. And then every 2 hours, what I would do, because I work either in the library or in coffee shops, I would change scene every couple of hours. I would get up and I'd go somewhere else. And by doing that, I found it kind of just refreshed me enough to get me through another couple of hours, and then I do it again and again, and until, you know, there were times when, and you know, this is, you know, you're talking about like these big literary kind of like discussions and stuff, where, you know, actually some of this stuff was edited in McDonald's on a Saturday night because it was the only place that was open and serving coffee. So there's quite a contrast. So I listened to this when I walked into work. Whoa!
Listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and our studio guest today is Benjamin Johncock, author of The Last Pilot. And you're going to read an extract now for us, Benjamin, yeah?
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit from the very beginning, from the prologue. It was a stretch of wretched land, bleached and beaten by the relentless salt winds that howled in off the Atlantic, forsaken by God to man for the testing of dangerous new endeavours. "Welcome to Cape Canaveral," the sign said. "Speed limit 17,400 miles an hour." 3 miles south sat Cocoa Beach, the Cape's resort town, so low-rent that even the giant chiggers wanted to escape it. In daylight, Cocoa Beach was cobaltic blue, coconut palms, and low-rise motels called the Starlight and Satellite and the Polaris, a replica rocket clasped above each name. The beach was like a strip of asphalt, long and wide and barren and hard. You could bend a spade on it. At sundown, mosquitoes the size of a clenched fist clustered at the water's edge. At night, it was infested with sandflies that stripped skin from muscle. The only visitors were young men racing cars in the occasional couple, lured out of their motel room by the slink of the murky sea and the promise of God knows what on the bare, hardback sand. Cocoa Beach was the kind of place where people ended up. It was late, past nine, the diner was empty. George's had low lights, a high bar, and a couple of Chesley Bonestell originals hanging on the wall. It wasn't a bad place. He came here because no one else did. His heart hurt like hell. He pulled a half pack of Lucky Strikes from his top pocket. He stuck one in his mouth and struck a match and lit it and waved the match until it went out. He looked at his hands, the thick hair on his fingers, his knuckles. He drank the rest of his beer. Steely eyes gleamed down from a billboard across the street. Was it Shepherd or Glenn? He didn't know or much care. He just wanted the goddamn thing to stop staring at him. He stared at his food. He wasn't hungry. A couple entered. The man held a grey hat between two fingers and the woman adjusted her dress as they waited to be seated. The waitress gathered plastic menus, ushered them to a table, presented the specials. The couple smiled at each other and he wondered if they were honeymooning. Smoke clung to the pine panel walls, lilting slowly toward the linoleum floor. The man approached his table. "Excuse me," he said, "sir. Sorry to bother you and all, but my wife," he glanced back, "we was just wondering, well, you're one of them, ain't you? What we've been hearing about? The new nine?" He stayed seated, pulled hard on the cigarette, his throat tightened. "I knew it, honey, I was right." The woman joined her husband. Her skin looked pale like a lake in late fall. "My wife, Betty," he said. "Pleasure to meet you," she said. "Now, which one are you? You're Borman, right?" "Honey." "Lovell. No, wait, I know this." "You'll have to excuse my husband. We've just heard so much about you all. Harrison. Jim Harrison. I knew it. Jim Harrison." The man looked at the woman, and the woman stared at the table. "Sure, I hope you don't mind us intruding," the man said. "We've been staying down in Miami at the Plaza," the woman said. "It's been a wonderful 3 weeks, but the other night I said to Bill, Bill, let's get in the car. Let's explore a little. It's a caddy, powder blue, a coupe. So we drove up the coast, just the two of us. I said we should go visit the world's first spaceport. I didn't know what he meant, but I never thought we'd run into one of you fellas. A real astronaut, my goodness. A thing like that." Harrison put out his smoke and stood to leave. "It sure was good to meet you," Bill said, extending his hand. "And thank you for everything, really. Thank you." Harrison nodded and shook his hand. The couple returned to their table. In the restroom, he pissed and thought and stood there for a long time. At the door, the waitress rang up his check. "Everything all right for you, hun?" she said. He stared at the register. Hard cracks crossed the linoleum under his feet. His heart beat hard in his head.
Thank you, Ben. I think what's good about that as a prologue to it, it reminds you of the status of these men at that time. It was like they were members of One Direction, really.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It was. They were superheroes. They really were. They were rock stars.
People knew their names. I mean, it'd be a hard push now. It's a shame now, but we'd be a hard push now to name the current set of astronauts.
Yeah, absolutely. And back then, this was time, obviously, before social media, and where you just had television, you had newspapers, and they were famous, properly famous.
And I'll take issue there, because you said you weren't very good at description, and yet we heard in that piece beautiful descriptions, and there are beautiful descriptions in the novel particularly about the weather and the landscape.
Right, right.
Obviously, you decided to focus on those. How did you get that right? Did you go there? Did you?
No, I hadn't really been to America before, actually, and I didn't go researching the book. I've been once when I was a student for 3 days when the first Star Wars film came out, and I wanted to watch it before it came out in the UK. So a friend of mine was on holiday and he said, well, why didn't you come over? And so being, you know, a student and fairly carefree, I flew over and spent 3 days in the movie theatre in Washington. So I didn't really get to see much of the country. No, I just, you know, in terms of my research, I read a lot of books. And I watched a lot of stuff. I mean, luckily, you know, this has been one of the greatest, most well-documented series of events, you know, really in history. So I had a huge amount of resources available to me at the time. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say.
Well, it's in living memory as well, isn't it? Which makes it challenging to write about, because there's always going to be somebody who says, you know, no, the uniforms weren't that colour.
Yeah, actually, I've had a number of people from different areas who have worked on nearby bases, or have lived out in the Mojave, or have been part of the programme, or whatever, who have come up and kind of and said nice things, which means a huge amount, because it meant that I got those details right. Because it's a magic trick, you know. Fiction is a magic trick, you know. I'm writing a book, and you know, I'm making it up, you know, even if it's based on, you know, historical stuff, but I'm making it up. And you as a reader, you know, you are picking this thing up, and you are kind of suspending your disbelief, and we're entering into this kind of contract where we both know that what we're talking about is fiction, but we kind of just suspend our disbelief. So it's about really the mechanicalness, the mechanics of getting that right, so that I can just convince you that this stuff is authentic. You know, and authenticity is incredibly important to me. And so many of the details in the book are authentic that I took. And I kind of, like a magpie, would steal, you know, bits of information. Like, you know, we heard in that opening prologue, the diner that Harrison is having his dinner in, which was a real diner, and it had those things on the wall. And do you know what I mean? Like, and those kind of details are great for me as a writer, because they are just, these nouns are so solid that they can really anchor a scene in a very authentic way, in a way that if I was trying to make it up, you know, I don't think it would have the same effect.
Because the period of time covered in the novel is 1947 to 1968.
That's right.
So yeah, it's quite challenging. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that was a challenge, actually.
From, you know, really the end of the Second World War, yeah, through to the end of the 60s. That's quite, yeah, a volatile period of history.
No, absolutely. There's a lot of things that happen. And there were some things that were happening that I wanted to coincide with certain things in the story. So I wanted the breakdown of the Harrison's marriage to coincide with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and sort of to reflect those two things together. But at the same time, you know, one of the big events of the 60s in America was the assassination of Kennedy. But because that wasn't relevant to my story, and it wasn't relevant in the time period either, you know, there is no mention of Kennedy's assassination. You know, the characters, I think, talk about Kennedy at one point, sort of afterwards, like maybe a year afterwards or something. But because it wasn't relevant, I didn't want to just shoehorn history in for the sake of it, if you see what I mean. But there were certain things that I wanted to, because I knew they were happening at the same time, I wanted to make sure that they lined up for a certain effect.
That's a big call, isn't it? I understand why you made that call, because something like that can be so distracting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it does feel like, oh, well, you're writing about the 60s in America, well, you've got to put Kennedy in there. Well, no.
No, a good call. Right, we're going to sidestep a little for a while. We'll come back to you in a moment, Ben. But we'll hear now from Siobhan Costello. Siobhan is author of The Memorable Minute, a short guide on how to network. She ran her own hypnotherapy business for several years and now works as a business coach and mentor. She runs the Women in Business Network in East Anglia and helps entrepreneurs share their expertise by teaching them how to write a business book. Her website, or one of her websites, is called bestselleracademy.com, which suggests that it's possible to learn how to write a bestseller. And when I met Siobhan, I asked her if she really believed that.
I absolutely do believe that. However, that's not the purpose. That's not the reason why I named the company that. I come from the school of thinking that actually a business book, if you use it the right way and you use the material based on the book, then you can position the book in a totally different way. So you'll make a lot of money out of using the content to design programs and services. And then the knock-on effect of that is that that's actually going to sell your book. So it's actually the two go in tandem, the idea of having a best-selling book and a best-selling business.
And I suppose we should define at the beginning what we mean by a business book.
A business book is something that takes somebody through a journey. A business book is focused around learning a particular tool or a technique or a system, or taking somebody through your own personal journey in which they learn from it. So it's all about the transformation that your reader is going to have at the end of it. And usually when somebody reads a business book, they will know how to do something differently at the end of it. So that might be that they have tools and techniques for more confidence, or it might be they have the tools and techniques to create a different type of business or a different approach in their business, or use social media. A business book is the how-to. It's the tools and techniques that a person might need to deal with a particular issue or problem that they have.
And the people who come to you who want your help with this, what kind of backgrounds are they from?
They are usually business owners, predominantly women. That's just because I network amongst a lot of women's network groups. And they're usually about a year into their business, if not more. And they may be struggling to get clients, struggling to grow their business. and they're looking for a way to make themselves different from their competition, and that they know a book will help them to do that, help them to showcase their expertise.
Somebody can be a good business person but not a good writer. What do you do then?
Absolutely. That's why I encourage people to think about, you know, what they've already got within their business that they've already designed. So maybe that they have course material, workshops. Bringing that into a book format enables them to have that first draft. And then I always say to people, if you're going to go on the self-publishing journey, there are two things you should really spend your money on. And one of them is a really good editor. Somebody who edits their book in the right way, and you know they're really producing a quality product. And the second thing I encourage them to spend their money on is cover design.
And is it true that you might get people who they've been running a business for years, but they think, you know, I couldn't put this all in a book, or actually, you know, people wouldn't want to learn this from me, and actually they've probably got a massive set of skills to share.
Lots of people have those gremlins that come into their mind, and they, you know, who am I to write the book? What will happen if people ask me questions? What happens if I don't sell it? So they've got all of those sort of limiting beliefs. And the thing is that they're already running a successful business. They've probably already got clients who love what they do. I help them to really get over those challenges, to get over those limiting beliefs, and really see what their value is. And the more they start that writing journey, the more they really hone their skills and start to see how valuable is this material is that they've already got, and how they can bring about that transformation for their clients in a totally different way.
And why would somebody write a business book?
Some people are looking for a way to grow their business, and a book is a fantastic way to showcase your expertise, to make you a person of influence, make you different from your competition as well. Because everybody says they want to write a book, but not everybody manages to finish it. It helps you get clients because you're seen as this expert, you're the go-to expert on that particular subject. It also helps you when you're writing to get clear on your offering. So if you have a stepped system of some sort or a program, when you start to write about it in a book, you really get clear on your message, what it is you love to do. And actually, you start to get rid of the rest. In effect, it has this knock-on effect on the practicalities of what you do in your business itself, because you start to think, well, actually, I don't really want that. That doesn't make sense now anymore. The other reason that people might want to write a book is if they are developing a new business model and they want to demonstrate to a particular readership, you know, what this model means.
And is this a gross market area? I mean, I'm thinking when I go into bookshops, there's lots of business books and self-help books, but do you think there's still space for more?
There's a huge market for it, a huge market. And because of the changes in publishing, people don't have to wait for a publishing deal now. There are other routes to market. Self-publishing has been a way in which people can really get there to their target market quickly, knowing that they've got to produce a quality book.
And you're talking about quality there. What does make a good business book?
The first thing I say is that people have to know who they're writing it for. The one key mistake that business writers make is that they say my book is for everyone. And it's not for everyone, because you can't market a book to everyone. It's not going to appeal to everybody. So the first point to make it a good book is to really identify who is it that I'm writing this book for. So that gets your tone, the language right, how you want to deliver it. It also affects the structure. So the structure has to be right, because with a self-help or business book, you are leading somebody through a journey of transformation of some sort. So each chapter has to build on the learning from the last. The other thing that's really important about a good business book is understanding your core message. So what is that transformation you want to have? What is the end point for the reader?
I think for those of us who don't read business books that frequently, we think of them as they can be quite dry. But what you're describing, as you say, it is a journey. It does have human interest in it.
Here's the thing. I'm passionate about business books. My bookshelves, I've got masses of business books. I just love reading them. So, you know, it is about what people enjoy most. However, some of those business books are quite dry. It depends on your target market and who you're appealing to. If people like things in a particular way, if they like inspirational messages and beautiful images of scenery, then that's why they'll buy the book. They'll be inspired by that. If they're more of a number cruncher, that might totally not grip them in any shape or form, and they want charts and graphs and things like that, and that will be very exciting to them. And yes, there are some that are quite dry out there, but it doesn't take a lot to make it different, to have a different approach. And these days, of course, with technology being the way it is, if your book is online, you can have click-throughs to various different, you know, things like videos and things you've recorded. So it can make it really interesting for somebody to read a book.
So you describe all those books on your bookshelf there, Siobhan. Is there one book that you keep going back to?
There is a book that has really resonated with me recently, and that's a book by Daniel Priestley, and it's called Key Person of Influence. Daniel has written several books, and I was really fortunate to be at a session with him recently and invite him for an interview on my podcast. But the book is all about how you build a successful business around being this key person of influence. And he's a real advocate of writing a book to show your expertise and to grow your business in that way. But he also talks about other steps, about how people should think about collaboration and joint ventures together. So he's got some key steps in it that I've found really valuable in my business. I think if you're a business owner, it's got to be one of those books that you pick up and read. I know you'll get a lot of information from it, really.
And what's your own background? How did you come to this?
I have written my own business book. It's called The Memorable Minute, and it's the first in a series of networking bites. I'm a networking expert. I like to think I am. I run several network groups across East Anglia. The guide is about how to pitch yourself, your business in 60 seconds. You wouldn't believe how much trauma it creates in somebody to go to a network meeting and feel that stress of having to stand up in front of everybody. So that was really what, you know, was my core message from the book, was how can I make this easy for people to do. It is part of a series that I'm writing of different ways to network, how to network effectively. First of all, I was a coach, simply helping therapists and coaches to design their programs and services. But in contact with those, they were often still struggling to grow their business. Some of them had actually written books, and the book would be in their handbag. And I'd think, why has business not taken off? Because here's this woman with this book. What's gone wrong here? And actually, that's what led me to set up Bestseller Academy, because I wanted to be able to say to people, you know, you have this gold dust in your hand. This is a diamond encrusted business card you've got here. So how can we make the best of it?
That's Siobhan Costello there talking about writing business books. Siobhan's website is greatbusinessresults.co.uk. Just listening to Siobhan talk there, Benjamin Johncock, she's often talking about people making complex things simpler, understandable. And it did make me think about your book, because there is science in necessarily and physics in your book, because it's about space, yeah. Space flight. How did you, was that easy for you to understand?
For the most part, yeah, because I only use technical details when I absolutely needed to. There is one section in the book where I wanted to show Harrison burying himself in his work after, you know, a tragedy occurs. And I thought, well, I could write that, or I could show it. And so I embarked on a couple of pages of very technical stuff to show Harrison burying himself in his work without having to spoon feed it to the reader. But in doing that, I had to sort of learn about the hyperthermal dynamic capabilities of the X-15's wings and stuff. And it was very, you know, poring over all these original documents, which is, you know, what's great. I get all this stuff online in the library and stuff, and just trying to figure out how all this kind of thing works. So that was a challenge. That was a challenge. But then in terms of getting the story to link into what I wanted it to do, get history to do what I wanted it to do, there were some things I had to understand. There's a section in the book towards the end, quite a dramatic section involving Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott in Gemini 8. And there is a very real chance that those two men will die in space, and it would have been NASA's sort of first death in space. So I had to link up what was going on there with what was happening with Harrison. And so I did have to understand the mechanics of it, so Harrison could respond in a meaningful and appropriately accurate way.
I mean, the science is there. It's certainly not distracting. That section you talk about, as a reader, you know, in a way, you don't have to understand that.
That's
all
right.
You need to know
what
he does.
Yeah, all you need to know is that he is, you know.
And he's a very clever man.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's next for you then?
Writing my second novel at the moment, which is going really well. I've been working on it for about a year. You know, a good piece of advice someone gave me once was, you know, start your second book before the first one comes out. Which is very wise. So I've been working on that for about a year. I've had an Arts Council grant for that, which has been amazing, and tremendous. The support I've had from the Arts Council have been tremendous, and so I'm sort of in the process of writing the first draft, but actually it's kind of the 10th draft, if you see what I mean.
Is it a similar subject to?
No, it is set in the States, but it's set in about 1809 in Mississippi.
Oh, very different. And short stories, because prior to this, your background really was in short stories. Are you still writing short stories?
The short stories kind of was a way, I kind of wrote them concurrently with a book, and it was kind of a way to do something different, to kind of have variety and to kind of work out how to construct these things, and then to kind of refresh myself in terms of coming back to the longer fiction. So I had a short story that was long listed for a prize a few months ago, which was great, but I'm just writing a children's picture book at the moment. So again, it's just something that's very different to what I'm doing that I can kind of hop onto when, you know, things are hard on the novel, if you see what I mean.
Wow, well, that's a different challenge altogether than a children's picture book.
Very much so, but you know, a lot of things are similar in the sense that, you know, efficiency, simplicity, being able to say a lot with very few words, you know, those things, skills, hopefully I'm carrying across to the picture book.
Wow, that pencil is busy.
Yeah, that pencil is busy.
Well, we've come to the end now, but it's been great talking to you, Benjamin.
Thank you so much.
We're going to hear your last choice of music in just a moment. But just a reminder that all podcasts of old episodes of Bookmarks are up on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm. Benjamin John Cox's novel, The Last Pilot, I highly recommend to you. It's published by Myriad Press. In our next Bookmark, our studio guest will be Woodrow Phoenix. He's a graphic novelist. We'll also have interviews with fellow graphic novelist Jade Sarson and Shaun the Sheep writer Glenn Dakin. Very excited about that.
Love Shaun the Sheep.
We all love Shaun the Sheep. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Benjamin, which is Soul Asylum. Can't even tell. Why this one?
This dates back to when I had my first ever job. I worked in the bakery in Sainsbury's, and I was a diligent worker and had a good attitude, but wasn't given the hours I wanted. This is before zero contracts and stuff, and was mucked around quite a bit. So I, being the enterprising young fellow I am, I got a job doing exactly the same thing, but at Safeway's, which was the rival. And the manager kind of called me into the office and grilled me about it and said, you've got 3 days to quit. You've got to choose one of these things. And I didn't like the sound of that. So I went into the next meeting, but I had a dictaphone in my back pocket, and I recorded what was actually an hour's worth of bullying and threats, and I typed the whole thing up and I sent it off to head office, and you know, he got a written warning and made to apologize and gave me all the hours that I wanted. So don't bully kids, basically. And this song I'd listened to on the way home from work, because it very much was a kind of two fingers up at the man.